No, I'm not brave, but we have a couple of questions which might be a sort of reply or keeping on with the issue. The first is, it's not really a question, but if you could instruct us as being young scholars about the term, the terminology and the concepts of food democracy, food sovereignty, food citizenship, are they synonyms, or shall we be, you know, suspicious, careful in using each of them in different contexts while investigating, let's say, food security issues? And the second thing is the timing and the relationship between, let's say, pure research and advocacy. You have got this long-lasting experience in activism, advocacy, and you are asking us how do we plan to be effective in our research and beyond our research. But I think there are also dangers in becoming an advocate before having reflecting upon things. So what's the timing? What do you suggest we should do?
Mm-hmm. That's great. Okay, so I want to just ask if there are any other kinds of related questions to this, or if there are any responses that you have to give on these points. Give you time to swallow. Yeah.
No.
Yes.
I wasn't here. I came in a little bit late, so I don't know if introductions were made, but I teach in the theology department. And I do work on war and conflict and women's issues, and also a little bit on ecology, but not a lot. But the one big question that's in my mind that you suggested, and I think the scholar at Tufts brushed off too quickly, is the question of, even if we have all these noble and fairly general ideals, such as human dignity of all, equal rights and duties, preferential option for the poor, solidarity, you know, food security, very few people will deny those at the general level, but at the practical level, there isn't political will, and instead to ensure that they're actualized, and therefore, a lot of times Catholic social teaching just seems to float over the heads of the political realities. And it's very nice sounding, and social scientists are probably amazed to discover that there are these progressive ideas, you know, but at the concrete level, what work can it really do? And I think in his encyclical on ecology, the Pope is actually getting into this, because he says the UN has been ineffectual. He talks about national interests, business interests. So he's identifying those, you know, religious term would be structural sin and personal sin that obstructs. But the big question is, like you said, who has human dignity? And I didn't hear you as suggesting that you thought not every human being had human dignity. It was rather that you were saying that not every social system respects the dignity of all as equally human.
That's what I was saying.
And so to say, well, we don't even raise that question is kind of naive, and, you know, I mean, we have to, you know. So I think the Pope is raising that.
Not necessarily in those terms,
but to me, that's the huge question. So how do we, or religious actors or other advocates, really change the situation effectively? That's the big question.
Okay, so I'll respond to these first three, and then we'll take some more. The issue of the language of demands, I guess that's the way we would say that. The language of food sovereignty, for example, is a language that sometimes conflicts with the language of human rights. And this is an academic conflict. An academic conflict because human rights are mainly proclaimed and adjudicated by lawyers, like Phil Alston, you know, he said, that's why we lawyers, we do it. Whereas the food sovereignty issues are the way are developed as platforms for advocacy and demands on the part of, in some cases, national states vis-a-vis the international trade system. That is, in some cases, what they're saying is, we have food sovereignty, and the World Trade Organization or other kinds of trade regimes can't tell us what we should be producing or eating or distributing. That's the state demand. But the term actually began when indigenous peoples were protesting the ways in which states, particularly in Latin America, were seizing their land and making it impossible for them to preserve and to use and continue to eat their native foods. So food sovereignty is used in different ways, and these are, I want to make this this clear, that the human right to food has been adopted more and more at multiple levels, but originally, and its principal reference point are the relationships between states and the international legal system, which is why anything having to do with human rights, any language of human rights, was anathema to many struggling peoples who were trying to overthrow their regimes, because they said any human rights regime referred to the states that they were trying to overthrow, and they weren't interested. So there's a lot of very nitty-gritty linguistic, the language of language of policy speak here, and I would simply say in each case, really, if you're looking at issues, claims of food sovereignty, food citizenship, food democracy, look at who's making the statements. Who are they making the statements for and against? You know, who are their reference groups? And what are their motivations? And that's very important. Also important when you look at the interaction of those claiming food sovereignty over and against the private business interests. In terms of the timing and relationship between pure research and advocacy, which has always been a huge issue for anthropologists who didn't even entertain the idea that legitimate anthropologists could do advocacy or policy research until the 1980s, we didn't get involved in human rights. And my original work looking at human rights was to try to understand why anthropologists hadn't been more involved in the discussion. So if you're interested in that, I have a couple of articles entitled Human Rights in Anthropology or Anthropology and Human Rights. You can find that out. I sort of go through that history. But the issue is that anything one is doing with policy should have an evidence base. And one is doing research in order to provide that evidence base. The advocacy evidence base is going to be selective, and one must always be aware that the advocacy base is selective, that a research account is not going to be the same as an advocacy account, and simply be very, very aware of what the differences are. And again, ask who's presenting a point of view, what's their research base, and are they being even-handed, and if not, why not? And the principal place where this issue comes up, or one of the principal places on the right to food, is on the issue of breastfeeding. And male policymakers were always really reluctant to talk about breastfeeding. You know, women talk about breastfeeding and sort of get really upset. But the issue of giving a child a healthy start in the first 6 months through exclusive breastfeeding was a very important issue. And my Canadian colleague Penny Van Esterick was an advocate for breastfeeding, and she would go to meetings where Nestle's or Danone or Philips, you know, the big private breast milk substitute companies would be on one side, she would be on the other, and she said, I would present my research point of view, saying what were the advantages of breastfeeding and what were some of the reasons, very legitimate reasons, cultural reasons, gender reasons, work reasons, women didn't breastfeed. And she said, and then the companies would simply talk about, that's why we need formula. And they always won the debates. And so what she finally realized was that her research, which was even-handed, was not going to work on an advocacy debate platform, and she was going to have to be selective. So one of the things I do as a professor when I'm teaching hunger and human rights is I have students write research papers, and then their final assignment is to convert one of the research papers into an advocacy piece and talk about the differences in what they've communicated. And it actually is very, very effective work. And the dangers in not realizing what the differences are is that someone who's posing as a researcher will in fact be presenting advocacy that's not even handed. And one has to be very careful about these dangers. And we can talk more about that sometime. on the theology issues. So what impressed me to talk about who is a human being was going through the 20th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and all these wonderful statements by countries that didn't count women as citizens, right? So they had these laws on the books about non-discrimination. They were South American countries. Maybe they counted women as half people, but they didn't count indigenous people at all. And so this really, you know, brought me into the fore of thinking about, you know, who's counted as a human being and all these wonderful statements that country leaders are making in support of human rights. It's very, very important to see who's being counted within this, within the framework. And so we're looking, the UN lawyer, special rapporteur on human rights for the last 5 years, who's now no longer in this position, Olivier de Schutter, was very, very good in talking about how evaluators can look at the human rights performance of different places. They can look at three sort of classes of data. One is whether the country has enacted laws that are supposed to protect, respect, fulfill the right to food. So you can look at that legal framework. And that's usually what countries had done when they reported on their human rights records, or the way they were progressively realizing, that's the actual legal language, the human right to food. He then said, but you also, the next step is to look at implementation. You know, who did they actually provide money? How did they provide money for making sure that the provisions, say, for a food safety net program, which would feed hungry people during an economic transition, are they actually putting money into this program? And if so, who's getting it? So I recently heard a paper by South African colleagues who said, yes, government of South Africa has these programs for agricultural modernization, transition, and safety nets. And when we looked at who was actually getting the money, we couldn't find any of the money being spent in communities that were supposed to be getting the programs. And that was both for the agricultural assistance and also for the safety nets. And I'm waiting to see what their next steps are on these kinds of issues. The third issue, of course, is what are the outcomes? Are there fewer hungry children? How do we know? Are there fewer women dying in childbirth? How do we know? So we have three sets of evaluation criteria, which I think is a real step forward in terms of thinking about the human right to food and other kinds of human rights. And in particular, there's a lot of growing literature out there and, gosh, multiplying indices on gender and women's rights that suggest that there's a lot of attention to whether women have power within the family, whether they have political power within communities, whether they have national political status, but there's still a lot to be done. And Catholic social teaching, trying to understand these kinds of structural issues, is going to be an important part of the analysis and discussion.
Catholic social teaching doesn't target gender as a lens through which to look at those issues very often.
But they are looking at structural issues, and there are ways in which the structural issues can be then brought into a gender lens.
That's true.
Well, I'm curious, this is actually drawing on a question that Connor had asked to me before, but what you were asking us, what resources we think students and faculty and administration at a Catholic institution should have. I would love to have your recommendation. What resources should we be looking at, and where should we turn for information on how to combat?
Okay, so Caritas has continual flow of informational activities. Mm-hmm. Their summary reports are online. Catholic Relief Services and Caritas both have educational divisions, and they actually have sets of teachings for Catholic universities that provide a place to start a series of questions. And I would simply become part of those networks and get the continual updates and questions and create contexts where those discussions can take place in groups. I think that's, I've been impressed with what has been worked on there. And I think the I've always found that the National Conference of Catholic Bishops has also provided materials. These are from 1988, and I began interacting with them because I was interacting with Scott Appleby at Notre Dame, who was looking at the ambivalence of the sacred and what were the situations, what were the contexts that those concerned about religious and spiritual values could create that would bring a focus onto the positive aspects of religious experience, of religious organization, of ritual. What were the kinds of contexts in which these could go forward to try to provide case studies that would work there? So I would see what else is going on there at the Notre Dame centers that are looking at some of these human rights issues, which are funded by the widow of the founder of McDonald's. Yeah, I mean, the crux, very, very important source, and also for interreligious dialogue. What's interesting also with the Roman Catholic Service Agency materials is they provide a series of case studies of the countries in which they work. So if you're interested, if you're working and trying to understand what's going on in Haiti, they have a Haiti case study. If you're interested in sub-Saharan Africa, they have, I think, Malawi and Zambian case studies. And these kinds of case studies are the service agencies that are actually there on the ground interacting with the small farmers. It's not an abstract category. It's a very concrete kind of experience that they can tell you about. So you can think about how those farmers might be advantaged or disadvantaged by certain commercial activities in U.S. food value chains. So these are additional places to be looking. Catholic church organizations, I think, also interact quite directly with some of the fair trade, and particularly the no child slavery organizations, so that one can be sure that the kinds of refreshments that are available in various church related activities and other, and perhaps in one's own home thereafter, are accessing, sourcing products that don't increase the misery of children, women, and disadvantaged in developing countries for particular kinds of products like cocoa and coffee.
Great, thank you.
Yeah?
If you've had a chance to look at them yet, what is your opinion of the new Sustainable Development Goals at the UN, how they address the human rights hunger?
All right, so there are 17 Sustainable Development Goals, and I call it the indicator culture, because they are 169 indicators, and they're trying to figure out how can they, the policymakers, somehow streamline the indicators so they can see what's actually going on. And in terms of the food goals, so the difference between the Sustainable Development Goal number 1, which, to the surprise of the people of the policymakers who developed those goals in the year 2000, insisted on ending hunger, or putting in an indicator, several indicators for ending hunger, part of the ending poverty overall goal, has been replaced by two goals. First is ending poverty, and second is ending hunger. Ending hunger, promoting food security, and nutritional diet. Okay, so goal number 2 is the goal that addresses the material, substantive specifics of a right to food. And nutritionists are upset because there's not more on nutrition. They're upset that there's not more on nutrition in goal number 3 and the other goals, particularly the goals surrounding women's well-being. But I like to be positive and say, well, they've got everything in there. It's just kind of squeezed in, and one has to look at how well the substantive indicators are actually covering the lives of the women and children who are most vulnerable to hunger. The other thing to always keep in mind about Millennium Development Goals, Sustainable Development Goals, although it's attractive to look at them one at a time, the actual development impact relies on all the goals being addressed. And that's very important. That the well-being of children, their education, is related to whether or not they're getting sufficient vitamin A, vitamin D, and health care. In other words, they're not going to be able to take advantage of schooling, even if it's there, if they're sick and malnourished. These are they're linked. the well-being of women is not going to be able to contribute adequately to the economy if they're sick and undernourished. So it's very important to think about these as interrelated goals, but it's complicated, and sometimes I think it's purposely complicated. I think that the idea that children need adequate food, especially during the first 1,000 days of their existence, is a very powerful way to formulate a project for every country. Yes?
So I'm an environmental studies major, and I focus more on the ecology of what's going on. I approach that from a personal stance of concern about human rights, and that's why I essentially study what I study and why I'm so interested in food. And I'm very interested in the intersection with small farmers and our large food economy. As a country, as a city, as a school, specifically at UC, I look at that, and as on the international scale. What I've struggled with, I guess, is how we have these policies in place addressing human rights, addressing food security, yet we are run by, specifically here in a capitalist society, where big agriculture and efficiency from an ecology standpoint is the premier focuses in these areas. Mm-hmm. And I guess to reconcile the two has been something that I see coming from a more just personal standpoint, something that goes hand in hand, whereas here it's very easy to separate all three categories and say, well, we're looking for efficiency because that's going to feed the most people, or you can bring GMOs into that conversation.
Right.
And you talk about small farmers and you talk about then the human rights issue. But it's been very difficult for me, and very rare that I've seen the conversations come hand in hand. Even when we've had GMO conversations, people don't think about human rights issues. And so this is like great to have this conversation, but I was wondering, like, in the future, how do you see these intersecting more, or what hope do we have in that regard?
Okay, anyone else have a question along those lines? Comment? I always try to generate conversation. But that's a really important issue. So one of the aspects of the way in which the Caritas campaign, in their summary of what had gone on the first 12 to 18 months of their campaign on food for on one human family, food for all, was they specifically addressed how important is it to how important are the relative issues of addressing the farmer welfare, addressing small farmer welfare, addressing the attributes of the lives of households in those small farmer contexts? That is, do they have access to clean water? Do they have access to adequate food? Do they have access to health care? Those were some of the issues that came up. And they also then said, and how important is the right to food? And the conclusion across countries, these were developing countries, was that most important issue was to look at the resources and the particular constraints on small farmers directly, and that whatever Catholic agencies, service agencies might be doing there, most important issue was to address those. Second important issue was to look at the holistic context of those farmers, and did they have adequate health? Did they have access to water? Did they have access to seeds and to markets if these were going to help them? And particularly, how might the market-oriented projects affect them? But they then addressed the question of right to food, because there has been so much, the legal framework is and political mobilizations around the right to food, and they said, well, the right to food is certainly an important goal to have that in constitution in terms of the framework law, and in framework law, it's not something that actually affects conditions so much on the ground. It's important to have the right to food and that human rights discussion to try to motivate government. I think the verb they use is spur government, and I sometimes use the term prod or pressure government to behave to the kinds of policy behaviors that are going to respect and protect and provide options for small farmers, and also participation of small farmers. Well, those are very important, to prod government in those directions, or as they put it, to spur. And this will come about through a legal framework, and the government, and most governments at this point, have signed on to the international covenants that respect, protect, and fulfill the right to food. That's not what's going to bring about change on the ground. So what should we do? Well, I think it's important to have work on the substantive issues and then always refer to the larger legal framework as a way to discuss these issues of accountability. I think that's very important. Another point that comes up, though, with the Haritosum, the environment statement, is Pope Francis's emphasis on subsidiarity in terms of cultural ecology, where, again, the idea that there's much to learn from the many different cultural ways of relating to the environment that exist in the world. There's much to learn from the kinds of foods and food processing that societies have had. This real respect for culture is also something that the discussion of human rights can bring to the table, as the particular statement in the papal document is that it's not only a question of protecting biodiversity, plant species, but it's also a question of protecting cultural diversity, humankind species and culture. And that's a human rights discussion that can also exist at the grassroots level and relate to the government level.
I think we have time for maybe one more question, if anybody has something pressing.
This was just a footnote to the discussion. Professor Cahill was my colleague, and a couple of months ago in Saudi Arabia, they had jailed a lady who, for driving. The issue was she had undertaken to drive. And I was in contact with them in Saudi Arabia, and I recommended that they read Professor Cahill's writings, and they might get a better understanding of human rights, of the rights of women, you know. So I think that the type of work we do here as that you would do, you know, as a philosopher and a theologian, that will come into the world on some level and maybe change minds, you know.
So I want to have some closing comments if there are no other questions here. Got a minute or so. So as I said, one of the really defining moments in my working on these issues was that encounter. I guess I'll use the language of encounter with Phil Alston, this wonderful legal advocate for human rights, particularly for children's rights and the right to food. His outburst about who is a human being, and then encountering the language of human dignity, which is so important as we talk about human rights. So that was really one really defining moment on my work on the right to food. The second, as I mentioned, was encountering Scott Appleby and also Mark Gopin, who's an Orthodox rabbi who works on various aspects of human rights and poverty. And both of them, in their writings and in their work, try to find these religious idioms for good. And they're focusing on religious values such as hospitality, fairness, human dignity, forgiveness, ritual. And these are values that spiritual communities, religious communities can bring to the table that are so important for actually making human rights resonate at the level of people. This is what people understand. The third concerns the value of adequate food and response to hunger. And that was an encounter I had with Hershey Lehman, who's an Advent, an Adventist, and he's works with ADRA, and he's he attended both our board meetings at the Brown University World Hunger Program and also Bread for the World workshops on the right to food and hunger. And the Bread for the World economists were really talking about the right to food and about its, you know, how important it was for efficiency and nutrition as an input and output of development, you know, all of these things. And about, you know, how you could convince economists, which is they were there with World Bank people, you know, trying to convince economists why the right to food and adequate food and nutrition were so important. And then Hershey Lehman just kind of took the floor and he said, well, I embrace adequate nutrition, adequate food, right to food, because the presence of any human being who's hungry diminishes me as a human being and all humankind. And that's also on a perspective that a religious spiritual discussion brings to the table. And finally, what I also find so energizing and inspiring is the language of caring for the stranger and hospitality, safety, protection, life-giving, sharing of resources as part of a discussion of good and evil. Because policymakers don't talk about evil. They sometimes talk about good, but they don't usually talk about evil. They talk about policy failures. They talk about policy misfires. And I'm always brought back to certain kinds of biblical references, and I guess the one that's on my mind as I was preparing this discussion were the commentaries on Sodom in the book of Genesis, where Sodomites were considered to be evil. How evil? Well, we know that they were really evil because they didn't protect the rights of the stranger. They were inhospitable. But then there's additional commentary in some of the early commentaries that say, how evil were they? Not only didn't they feed the hungry and protect the stranger, but they punished anyone in their midst who did. And so I think it's very important to realize that this kind of clarity, this kind of moral clarity, I think comes from our respective religious traditions, and I hope that we will ever find ways to keep church and state separate, but make sure that the conversations and the interactions go on. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you.